This is Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our web address is libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org. Today we are discussing with Professor Todd Zawicki his latest co-authored book, Consumer Credit in the American Economy. Todd Zawicki is George Mason University Foundation Professor at George Mason University School of Law. He is a senior scholar of the Mercatus Center, and he is the former director of the Office of Policy Planning at the United States Federal Trade Commission. Todd, welcome to Liberty Law Talk.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me here.
So let's talk consumer credit. Now, what may seem an enterprise of that's rather boring, we all use it, but we don't really think about it too much. And to the extent we think about it, we largely think of credit cards and large credit card companies maybe manipulating us with teaser rates or offering us good deals at the beginning and then yanking those, or if we miss a payment date, our payment suddenly skyrocket, things like that. You've written about it along with three other co-authors from the angle of the history of the growth of consumer credit and also the regulatory side and then how consumers use it and their daily lives and the different facets of consumer credit. Before getting into the book, I want to discuss with you, you famously squared off against, among others, Elizabeth Warren in 2005 over the Bankruptcy Reform Act. Besides what you learned about Elizabeth Warren's animus against those she disagrees with, what did that debate reveal to you about consumer credit, bankruptcy, and, say, over-leveraged households in America?
Well, two things, Richard. I mean, that was an interesting experience because, in many ways, that experience of squaring off with Elizabeth Warren sort of was the foundation of this book, which is what I discovered during that process. It was revealed to me that there are two very different ways of seeing the world and thinking about consumer credit. And that was sort of an interesting learning experience for me, which is going into that experience as a bankruptcy lawyer, I had the same idea that a lot of people had, which is that consumers were over-indebted, that credit cards were causing people to borrow and live beyond their means and maintain, you know, lifestyles that they couldn't afford. And I thought it was just a matter of sort of where that came from. What I discovered in trying to understand why bankruptcy filings had risen so much, so if you look at the 80s and 90s and the 2000s, during a period of one of the greatest periods of prosperity in American history, what we saw was bankruptcy filings go from about 250,000 a year to 1.5 million a year. And I just couldn't find any evidence in the data that people were getting into trouble more often, interest rates were low, unemployment rates were low. And what really revealed to me, and I know we'll talk about this more, is what was really striking to me was there was no evidence, when you actually looked at it, that credit cards were causing people to get more in debt. And so in many ways, that was sort of the a light went on for me. The second thing that revealed to me is about two different worldviews and the way of seeing the world is what that taught me was that consumers are smarter than we give them credit for, that people do respond to incentives. And so really what came out of that was an understanding that the reason why bankruptcy filings rose so much had to do with the incentives to file bankruptcy in a variety of different ways. And it wasn't just that people were being driven into bankruptcy involuntarily, but we had set up a system that affected the incentives. And so one of the things that has been not surprising to me, but surprising to my critics, is that as soon as we tightened the bankruptcy laws, bankruptcy filings went down. And we put more conditions on bankruptcy. People responded to that. Bankruptcy filings have gone down. They went back up during the Great Depression, have gone back down. So to me, what that really taught me was consumers are smarter than we give them credit for, that people do learn over their lives rules of thumb of how to manage credit, and they respond to incentives just like anybody else does.
Coming out of the 2008 financial crisis, in large measure, not caused by consumer credit, we might say an excessive amount of subprime and unconventional mortgages issued to consumers, who then in large measure rationally walked away from a lot of those mortgage contracts, has the value of the home declined. They had little down payment invested in them, et cetera. But we also had, after this financial crisis, we had, or in its wake, the great deleveraging of American households, paying off consumer debt, not taking on more consumer credit. Didn't this in some way, though, reveal to us that Americans had just taken on too much debt, either through mortgages, through student loans, through consumer credit cards, auto loans, et cetera, that in some way we just sort of realized we couldn't keep going the way we were, and we had to live lifestyles much more balanced and much more on the side of living within our means?
Well, obviously, we'll be thinking about the financial crisis for a long time, but one of the things that we've discovered when you look closely at it is, I mean, obviously those loans that the banks made were incredibly stupid loans. But what made them stupid was that the structure of incentives that they were setting up for people, as you identified, they were making nothing down loans to people. And when those loans went underwater, people basically looked at the numbers and decided to walk away.
Yeah.
An overwhelming majority of the foreclosures that came out of the financial crisis in the end were fixed rate, traditional prime mortgages where the house had simply gone down in value. And so in many ways, it reminded us again of the key lesson, which is the reason why those foreclosures were a surprise was because policymakers had assumed that people don't respond to incentives, that they don't think rationally about whether or not continuing to pay for a house that's not worth what the mortgage is a good investment. And so it taught us the folly of basing policy on the idea that that people are idiots, or that they don't respond. As to the larger question of the great deleveraging, we've seen this over time. We show this in the book, which is one of the oddities about consumer credit is there is a macroeconomic phenomenon here that can be kind of troublesome, which is that consumer credit can amplify business cycle fluctuations. And so I had a funny conversation a few years ago with a reporter from CBS MarketWatch. And she basically said, Professor Zawicki, we're headed for a recession, and people have all this, they've charged up their credit cards, and they have all this other sort of stuff. What's going to happen? And I said, well, they'll probably just start charging less. And she said, what? I said, well, people see a recession coming, and you don't just drive 100 miles an hour over the cliff. You actually kind of put the brakes on, right? And sure enough, that's exactly what happened, right? So partly what we're seeing is the natural adjustment we always see, which is consumer credit tends to be pro-cyclical. That in itself may be a macroeconomic problem because it tends to overheat, can overheat the economy when times are good and can deepen recessions when times are bad. That's an interesting macroeconomic problem, but it begins with the recognition that people aren't idiots. They don't just drive 100 miles over the cliff. That each individual household tends to pull back a little bit when they see economic times toughening up, and as the economy recovers, people do start to borrow again.
I mean, that's an interesting point, and I found that interesting in the part that I read of about this that somehow has people perceive economic growth, they perceive their own economic position being stable or increasing, they're needed more at work. I mean, all of the kind of signals people get to think positively about the economy. And in turn, they take on debt.
Right.
They take on debt, which seems counterintuitive to me, but I suppose in a highly driven consumer economy, you start to realize your appetites start to wake up, you want more, and you take on more debt, and you perceive you have the means to pay it off. But that kind of gets into a central point, and I think this is really where your book, if I'm right, tell me if I'm right, really rests its claim, that it's how one measures debt, and that is, are you making a stock-to-flow comparison or a flow-to-flow comparison? And I think this really gets into this idea that it being debt being pro-cyclical, because we always hear about the levels of consumer debt, which are staggering, and the growth of consumer debt. But you point out, and you quote an economist who worked for the Federal Reserve, last name Mackey, debt service ratio versus the amount of income someone has. That's the crucial measure. Talk about that.
Yeah, and that is really the key concept, I think, in reading these numbers, because as you said, what you tend to hear is that total debt or total credit card debt has reached all-time highs, right? But one of the things we often forget when we talk about that is interest rates matter, maturities matter, right? And what we saw over, you know, the 80s up until recently was a period of declining interest rates. So the most obvious example is you can pay more for a house if the mortgage interest rate is 3.5% than if it's 10%. And so if you only look at the size of the mortgage, you're missing the point if the interest rate is 3.5% rather than 10%. And you have to look at that more broadly. So the data we use that we think is the best measure of consumer indebtedness is what's called the household debt service ratio, which is collected by the Federal Reserve. And that's basically the amount of your disposable income every month that's dedicated to servicing your debt. So what matters more is the size of your car payment than the price of the car, in some sense. Your mortgage payment, your student loan payment, right? And that's more valuable because it takes into account interest rates, maturity rates, and that sort of thing. And so, you know, what we see is what you would expect, is that if interest rates go down, people borrow more. If interest rates go up, people borrow less. In that sense, they're no different from a business, for instance, which is doing the same thing.
On the rise of consumer credit in post-war America, I mean, I think this is also a part of this public perception that we are carrying a lot of debt or too much debt. It explodes in post-war America. You talk about that process a lot early in the book and the different types of credit. Is the problem now, and I say problem in quotes, that, you know, largely everything is happening through credit cards, and, you know, and people feel this in a direct way, whereas in the past you would have you might have a charge account at a furniture store. You would have an auto loan. You would have another charge account for appliances. And, you know, all these different sorts of ways of having credit. But now we largely combine. We have student loans. We have mortgages and credit cards. In my kind of back of the envelope calculation, and that's about it. But the credit card thing that we see every month is pretty large, and it's easily reportable. And journalists can pick up on this and tell this story. So.
Well, this is one of the key themes of the book, which is putting this in a historical context, whether it's the intellectual history, whether it's the history of consumers' use of credit, whether it's the history of the terrible experiences we've had with regulation of consumer credit. And in a nutshell, basically what it comes down to is as long as we've had consumer credit, we've had people are concerned about how other people are using consumer credit. So, you know, one of the things we often hear today is, well, it's not like the good old days. You know, it's not the good old days, like when people lived within their means. And as you said, what we demonstrate, I think, pretty clearly in the book is that the real growth in America consumer credit was in the post-war period. And maybe when you're a consumer credit economist, that's your hammer and everything is a nail. But in many ways, I think the history of 20th century America is the history of consumer credit, which is this is the backbone of all the changes we saw in American society. Is people left, you know, their rented apartments in the city with hand-me-down furniture and moved out to Levittown with the three-bedroom ranch and the car in the driveway and the, you know, the dishwasher and the refrigerator and the modern appliances. All that was financed on credit. And so what we see is a great growth of credit from 1945 to the 1960s. And since then, the introduction of the credit card has just changed the composition of credit without increasing it. So think, for example, in 1974, if you bought a bedroom set, as you said, you'd go to the furniture store and you'd put it on credit and you'd pay it off $50 a month or whatever till it was paid off. If you needed a refrigerator, you'd go to the appliance store and you'd pay it off to, you know, on a monthly installment loan. If you needed $500 for a car repair, you'd go to the local personal finance company, you'd pay it off, you know, $50 every 2 weeks or whatever, whatever the terms would be. Nowadays, you just put that all on your credit cards. And the irony of this, of people sort of talking about credit cards, if you look back at, you know, the proto-Elizabeth Warrens of the 1950s and 60s, the criticisms they make of installment credit are exactly the same criticisms you hear today about credit cards, about how, you know, they lure you in with the promise of easy monthly payments, right? My favorite one was lenders were criticized for, or you know, department stores were criticized for goading people into taking on debt, too much debt, my favorite was that they were especially bad because they were victimizing women, because, you know, women are bad at math. So so women were the protected class, or because they were bad at math, basically the retailers were taking advantage of them because they didn't understand this stream of payments. So it's kind of ironic to read these stories about how installment credit was criticized. I mean, think about it in the big picture. Thorsten Veblen, in 1899, Thorsten Veblen said, invented the theory of conspicuous consumption, which is that people are borrowing too much to keep up with the Joneses and buy things they don't need. 1899, we are already seeing these sorts of criticisms. And so I think there is a sense in which you're right. Maybe credit cards are more prominent. Maybe the ubiquity of credit cards it seems more prominent to people. But we've been awash in credit since the post-war era, and you know, a lot of those old-style forms of credit have gone away and been replaced by credit cards. But that hasn't increased household debt overall.
So let me know. You can probably crush me with data and tables and studies, but I just want to throw something. And I think this is anecdotal, but yet I think we all kind of sense this. We all kind of have the grandparents from the Great Depression who.
Right.
Fairly successful in life, certainly not even upper middle class. I think about my grandparents, all of whom entered into retirement with substantial amounts of money because they did live, they saved a lot of money. They really did live within their means. You know, we all have grandparents that seem to have multi-million-dollar pensions in it. But no, they also were working in the age of the pension, and also right the part of the American economy at the post-war where it just really owned the world, particularly our manufacturing sector. So maybe that goes without saying, but that's there. And when you talk to them, they are kind of, and you contrast that with our boomer parents, many of whom are now moving in with us. And this isn't anecdotal. I think there's a lot of evidence to support that. Does something not strike you there as off?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there's, you know, again, the history is fascinating, right? Which is, I think you're right. There was a great, during the Great Depression and the like, there was, during the war itself, there was a real decline in consumer credit. One of the things you see, it's interesting, is you look back in the period before that, in the 20s, again, in the 20s, what you see is large amounts of consumer credit, where people bought everything on credit in the 20s. They bought it on time, whether it was pianos or radios or sporting goods. The one I remember when I was a kid, this is a little bit later, but you may remember people buying encyclopedias on credit. You remember this? One letter a month. and there'd be the kid down the street whose family only afforded up to M. But it's amazing how much people, I mean, it's really quite striking when you look at the history, how much people bought stuff on credit. And the interesting intellectual history here is that in the 20s, there was a lot of consumer credit. And in the post-war, there was actually this undercurrent that most people aren't aware of, but coming out of the Great Depression, there was a theory, there was a strong belief that one of the causes of the Great Depression was overuse of consumer credit. Stop me if you've heard this story before, right? That people overused consumer credit in the 20s, and that was one of the reasons that caused the Great Depression. And so what you saw was a piling on of old regulations. They brought back usury restrictions and things like that to try to slow down consumer credit markets again. And, you know, that gets to the part of the book we'll talk about later on regulation and the unintended consequences of that. But there clearly is this sense. I mean, there are changes over time in this concern that people are overusing consumer credit as an old one. Now, what that doesn't answer is the question, how much is the right amount, right? Do we have what we say in the book is this is a trend we've seen over a long period of time. We saw it in the 20s. We saw it in 1945 to now. Does that mean that's too much or not? You know, we give a theory, we give an explanation on why it seems rational, but there could be macroeconomic issues, that sort of thing, that that we could have a discussion about what the overall impact of it is, even if, in our view, on each individual household, we can explain things pretty well as to what people are doing.
Yeah, no, I mean, now you bring up the fake economy, the fake Warren G. Harding, Calvin Coolidge economy of the 1920s. all built on air and fluff and credit, as you say. That's a progressive view. Amity Schlaes, in her book on Calvin Coolidge, talks about what was formative in his early experience as a boy in Vermont was the commitment of his father and grandfather to living within their means, no matter what. And one experience they had was a relative had to leave Vermont and go west, west being, I think, Minnesota or Wisconsin, because he had fallen into debt and really couldn't make it. And so he picked up and decided to move. And this was formative in Coolidge's mind. If you fast forward throughout his life, I mean, even when he's the governor of Massachusetts, he lives in a really small one-bedroom apartment with his wife. He kind of keeps this idea, and he thinks this is actually essential to American freedom of living within your means and disciplining your appetites. And it's so much so, if I recall, when he's president, several companies sense that he's kind of against this idea of the growth of installment credit, as you discuss, and they want him to sort of kind of give a public endorsement, which he kind of does, but it's a two cheers kind of endorsement for consumer credit. And when I think about that, and we can explain household level debt, it's maybe not burdensome, and yet you can say what do Americans actually save, and I think and kind of hold that together with what Coolidge's fear was, which was that even if Americans can largely pay their debt service on credit cards and their auto loans and all of that business, are they ever actually becoming free and independent citizens who are building their own wealth and are going to be able to retire at a certain point rather than be, say, Walmart greeters or something like that, worst case scenario? Are they actually going to become free citizens, or are they perpetually necessitous because they're in debt? And I think that was Coolidge's fear. And then a larger fear was you would connect that with citizens in debt see little reason why they should discipline the federal government. Why can't it be perpetually in debt? So those are right. Two questions kind of beyond your book, but yet things that are in my mind as I'm reading your, you know, heavily economist type treatment of the situation.
No, those are marvelous questions, Richard. And I think, you know, one of the things you hit on that, as you said, our book doesn't really get into this, and I think is probably my next book that needs to be, is the interrelationship of all this with larger society and that sort of thing. And in many ways, I think maybe two cheers for consumer credit is the right way to think about it, in the sense that obviously people can overuse consumer credit. People always have overused consumer credit. As you said, people, in the Coolidge family were able to overuse consumer credit in the past, and so it's always something we want to be concerned about. But it appears that in terms of overuse, it's a relatively small minority who overuse it, number one. And number two, people do tend to learn over time. But I think the larger question that you get at, and why I think maybe two cheers is right, is it gets to the question, the fundamental question that I think most people think about this is, why do people borrow? And there's really two different views. One is what it sounds like is largely the Coolidge view, which is that borrowing for consumer credit is just kind of eating your seed corn, right? Yeah. It's just taking consumption from the future and bringing it to the present. And even people like Adam Smith bought into that idea. You know, Smith distinguished between business credit, which was investment and could, you know, sort of increase productivity and repay itself, versus consumer credit, which was just shifting the timing of consumption. The argument we make in the book, and this is, I think, the core economic concept in the book, is that by and large, we argue consumers use credit for the same reason businesses use credit, which is businesses use credit to invest in capital goods, you know, to buy, instead of 10 guys dig a ditch with shovels, you get a backhoe and you can finance it, or you can get a new delivery van and make up for it in productivity, or a new printing press, or you name it, right, that they're, that they can invest in capital goods. We argue that that's what most of consumer credit is as well, which is, take a washing machine, for instance. The value of a washing machine is not just the immediate purchase value, like buying a pizza, but it's the stream of benefits you get over time of saving money and not having to go to the laundromat every Saturday. The example I love from history is cars, which is, I got interested in this. You know, I talked about the auto bailouts, but I got interested in this history during the GM Chrysler bailouts, and there was this interesting question of why did GM overtake Ford so rapidly in the 1920s to become America's largest auto dealer. That partly had to do with style and that sort of thing. But partly what it had to do is in 1925, General Motors rolled out the GMAC plan and allowed people to buy cars on time. Henry Ford, who had a background very much like you describe of Coolidge's, Ford, growing up in the Midwest, was very concerned about consumer debt. It also tapped into, frankly, his anti-Semitic impulses, which is that he thought the consumer debt was just a way that people were, get enslaved to the Jewish banking cartel. And so Ford's response was not to allow you to buy a car on credit, but to buy a car on layaway, send us a check every month for 10 years, and at the end of the time, we'll give you a car. Meanwhile, ride the bus, right?
Well, that's kind of like the Soviet Union. We'll send you a car 5 years from now.
Right.
I'm just kidding. Not to say that.
But as soon as you realize the absurdity of buying a car on layaway, why is that so absurd? Because you realize the value of a car is, that you don't have to take the bus, that you can get use value out of it. You could get productive value out of it. You could buy an asset with it. And once you start taking that basic idea of a car and you start thinking about houses and student loans and washing machines and, these sorts of things, you start to see that a lot of the reason why consumers use consumer debt is not just to shift consumption, but it really is kind of investment in productivity. And so that's where we take issue, which I'm not prone to take issue with Adam Smith, but on that issue, we take issue with Adam Smith, which is what looks like consumer debt a lot of times is actually really investment and that sort of thing. Now, where it is, right, how much is good sort of investment that's similar to a business versus really just shifting consumption over time, we come down on the side that most of it is sort of more investment type related. And so while people overuse credit, just like businesses sometimes overuse credit, we shouldn't think of that as the norm. We should think of the norm as being people use credit to make their lives better, to invest, to make investments, to smooth income and expenses the same way businesses do. And I think that really reorients how we think about the common sense of people in using credit and the potential dangers of shutting off credit to people.
There was a discussion of 401ks earlier this week in the Wall Street Journal, in the personal journal section, and this really struck me as strange and unfortunate. But it was a discussion of how large 401ks are. Maybe 5,000 Americans have 401ks with a value of $5 million or greater. And the thinking is that these need to actually be taxed, or the government needs to actually come in and take that, of course, because these people are improperly using the 401k. And all the Roth IRA, et cetera. But one of the things that it noted at the table is Americans in their 45 to 55 range, the size of their 401ks, and a very most of the 401ks concentrated are under $125,000 in value, if I remember correctly, which struck me as woefully inadequate. That is woefully inadequate, but also for people of that age. Now, there's some qualifications we can make. The 401k revolution in investing really is a kind of a post-Cold War thing, my understanding. And so the boomers and those they kind of get the shaft. I think they've got to pick up mid-career with changing how they're thinking about retirement. So maybe that explains
right.
it. We've also got the 2008 financial crisis. Of course, the markets have come back as long as you stayed in them. But I just keep thinking Americans are putting too much in debt, not enough forward and equity to build something for themselves. And that kind of brings into play what the behavioral economists say. We have all these biases, as you know. We have all these problems in thinking through and reaching our true self-interest. I suppose they can define what that is. But in any event, here's one case maybe where we would agree people should be investing more for their retirement, for the time when they're going to get sick and not be a burden on others, not be a burden on the government, to say the least, and Social Security, of course, needing to reform that in some way. So is there not, in a sense, kind of a point there that it would be good maybe to nudge people more towards investing and away from present-day consumer credit and what that's doing?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about behavioral economics in the book, and one of the points we try to make is, the behavioral economics, in some sense, is nothing new. For a very long time, economists have been using psychology and those sorts of concepts along the same way to look at how consumers use consumer debt. And the significant point we make is that while those ideas may change around the margins, some of these ideas I've talked about, in the end, they do not defeat the basic model, in our view, that we lay out, which is that consumers pretty much act rationally, that we can explain most consumer behavior through this lens of people making capital investments and financing in the same way that businesses do, and that consumers don't constantly give in to temptation and the like. And, you know, we've written as a complement piece, a article people can find online on credit cards specifically, where we test the behavioral law and economics, the hypotheses about credit cards and find them wanting. And so there is a sense in which a lot of the things that we think are new are old. My sense is, you know, that a lot of the concerns that people are undersaving are things we've heard for a very long time, number one. Number two, there also is a sense, we don't go into this in the book, but I've gone into this in my own scholarship, which is the baby boomers are a bit of a unique generation, it turns out, in American history. Harsh to put it this way. It sounds kind of harsh, but they are kind of uniquely financially reckless and irresponsible generation, which is, if you look at the swath that the baby boomers have cut across the economy, all the way through, they've had higher bankruptcy filing rates than both generations ahead of them and behind them. They save less than Gen Xers and everybody else. There is this peculiarity with the baby boom generation that we don't really get into. And I, you know, many ways I find Frank Fukuyama's old book on the Great Disruption insightful about the baby boomers, and I've written on this. But it is a concern. I mean, we do hear these concerns that people don't save enough. I'm not sure. I mean, we'll see how it turns out at the end of the day. You don't hear about people. We've been hearing for a long time people don't save enough. But at the same time, we don't hear people sort of dying in the gutters in America. So we don't know exactly what's going on. We also know that when you increase social welfare benefits, it's clear in the data that people save less. Yeah. That people basically allow the government to save for them. There's also the concern, which is, if we try to force people to save more today, we don't know what happens to that. If we force them to save more of their paycheck, does that mean they just borrow more, on the other side? I think we tend to be a little bit glib about kind of these things. There is one concern, though, that I think we don't talk about that much in the book, but we talk about it, which is student loan debt is a problem, which is the logic of student loan debt makes sense, right? Which is, as I talked about earlier, investing in human capital development. Yeah. But we've not seen anything in American history, not even the housing crisis, we've not seen anything in American history like the way that people have strapped on consumer loan debt over the past 20 years or so. And it really begins in the early 1990s during the Clinton administration, where people were sold student loan debt as being good debt, where the government increased the ability to borrow. And in the early 1990s, student loan debt was 1% of the average household non-credit consumer balance sheet, right? It was primarily car debt and credit card debt. Today, student loan debt is past credit card debt as the second largest source of consumer debt on the household balance sheet, non-mortgage debt, and it's gaining fast on car loans. Most people don't think about how much car debt there is out there, but car loans are big loans, and a lot of people have them. And student loan debt is creating a problem for people. Yeah, and yeah. I think that's something we need to think about. Obviously, we need to think about the expense of higher education, how many people should be going to college, and all those sorts of things. And so if there's any example that I think is troubling for our model and our sanguine approach to consumer loans, it may be consumer loan debt may be the one. I mean, student loan debt may be the one that I haven't fully reconciled with, which I think is something useful for future research.
But of course, the theme, I think, that would hold for both with the mortgages of 2008 that went sour, but also this rapid increase of student loan debt is government intervention. in that market space, which is distorting what people perceive as what
absolutely
they're buying and
right.
what they're taking on. And, you know, it's subsidized, right? It's
right.
We also we have officials from the government. Now it's a nationalized industry telling them, as you report, that this is good debt because all Americans need to go to college if you want to be in the middle class. So all of that
right.
is, if you take that away, who knows where it what the true market is. I mean, it could be good. You could actually incorporate yourself and sell shares in your future. That might be a way to go. So Harvard law grads, you can buy a piece of my misery as I work in a corporate law firm to pay off everything. How do you see the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau reshaping the consumer credit market? It's been in operation, since 2010? What is it? How is it already altered contracts, credit debt contracts, and what are its plans in the future? I suppose I was thinking, too, the French economist who won the Nobel Prize recently, Tyrol, he had his idea, as I understand it, the contracts should largely be principal and agency contracts or large contracts. I don't purport to understand his work, but is that kind of the model the CFPB is working from to structure the contracts in that way and not actually really constrain consumer credit in some way?
Well, that's what they say, but I think in the long run we have to watch what they do, which is in many ways, if they're, this book is targeted to CFPB and the current generation, which is what we see in many ways of the CFPB today with its restrictions. It looks like they're going to crack down on payday loans. They're, and reduce access to payday loans. Since the financial crisis, we've seen an onslaught of financial regulatory stupidity like we've never seen in American history, from Dodd-Frank to the Durbin Amendment price controls in Dodd-Frank on interchange fees, to the Credit Card Act of 2009, to the Qualified Mortgages Rule, which is reducing access to mortgage credit. One thing after another has reduced access to loans, either directly or indirectly, based basically on the idea implicitly that consumers can't handle credit. Now, what I think is interesting to me, having looked at all this history in this book, is this is really just the latest chapter in a story we've seen before. So if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, we see that for the first time, we see people leaving the farms and coming into the cities. We see immigrants coming into the cities, and they run smack up against the old Victorian lending laws, strict usury ceilings and the like. And what do we see? People need credit for the first time as they're in cyclical employment, seasonal employment. People have temporary job loss. And unfortunately, what happened was loan sharks proliferated. So basically what happened around the 1910s was, economically literate consumer finance people and consumer advocates say, it's better to allow people to get access to expensive credit than get their legs broken. And so that's what we saw was this deregulation in the 1910s and 20s, basically to allow people more access to credit. We see the prototypes of payday lending, for instance, which is called salary buying. As I mentioned earlier, then after World War II, or after the Depression, this theory comes out that the Depression was caused by too much access to consumer credit. What do? They crack down on consumer credit. They bring back usury restrictions. And so while credit grows, at the same time what we see is that, for instance, in 1968, a United States Senate report, a subcommittee report, says the second largest revenue source of the mafia in 1968 is loan sharking. And gambling is their only larger revenue source, but loan sharking, they report, is more profitable. So the mafia invests their gambling revenues in their loan sharking operations. In 1968, Richard Nixon's nomination acceptance speech in Miami for the Republican nomination, one of the planks is to crack down on the loan sharks in American cities. I have a headline that my co-author, Tom Durkin, is kept in a file for all these years. A report from the New York Daily News in 1973, when Anthony Fat Tony Salerno, the head of the Genovese crime family, was finally indicted on 11 counts of loan sharking and, yes, one count of criminal solicitation to have somebody's legs broken for not paying. He was running in 1973, $80 million a day outstanding on the streets of New York City in 1973. That's $463 million in today's dollars. And so in the 1970s, what we saw was it's better to allow consumers access to high-cost credit than having them go to Fat Tony Salerno because they need a car repair. And so we got deregulation. Stop me if you've heard this story again, right? Which is 2008, the story is people have too much access to consumer credit. We've got to put new restrictions on credit cards. We've got to put new restrictions on payday loans. We've got now the latest headline is subprime auto loans, you know, that people are overusing, and so we're going to crack down. And what have we seen? We've seen since that period, because of the Credit Card Act of 2009, among other things, the percentage of low-income consumers with credit cards fell 11 percentage points. It fell. Yeah. We saw as a result of the Durbin Amendment, about not just because of the Durbin Amendment regulating price controls, a million people have lost access to bank accounts. What has gone along with that? Payday lending has boomed. We see double-digit growth in payday lending as we've taken low-income consumers out of the mainstream financial system with all this system of regulation. We saw a report in the Wall Street Journal recently that as a result of the new regulations on mortgages, Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan have said, we're not making low-income loans anymore. Meanwhile, non-bank lenders, you know, the unregulated lenders, have increased their market share from about 10% to 25% in a year as the banks have exited the market and these other people have come in. Unfortunately, I think the CFPB is learning the same lessons we've seen again and again and again in American history, which is you can take away the supply, but you can't take away the demand for consumer credit. If your car needs if you need $400 to fix your car to get to work on Monday, you need $400 whether you got it in the bank or not. And if you don't have a credit card, you're going to go to a payday lender if that's your best option. And that's where the CFPB comes in, which is the CFPB is sort of on this crusade, and they're not focusing on the unintended consequences. And one of the things we hope with the book is that by looking back at this history and understanding that these experiments have been tried before and understanding that that economically unsound regulation hurts exactly the people it's intended to help, whether it's interest rate ceilings or whatever, hopefully we can avoid a lot of that tragedy and pain that we've seen in American history in the past.
Well, I suppose the view, I mean, who do you think, so we've got this tremendous growth in payday lending, which I wasn't aware of until you told me. Who was using payday lending, say, 10 years ago? I mean, who predominantly would go and seek help? Besides, I guess consumers who were maxed out on their credit cards maybe needed $1,000 or something. But, who else would?
Well, that's exactly what again, I think that, you know, the same model of how consumers use credit to some extent applies to how consumers use high cost or alternative credit. And we talk about this in Chapter 8 in the book, which is consumers have in their head sort of a rough pecking order. And it starts off, you know, leaving aside mortgages, they've got credit cards is the best thing, right? The middle class people basically use credit cards if they need credit. The people who use payday lending are and always have been people who either don't have access to credit cards, or if they use their credit card, you know, or they're maxed out on their credit cards. Mm-hmm. And so what they do is they search a lot, they try different things, and they end up taking a payday loan because it's the next best option to a credit card. And what we see is that people who use payday loans or bank overdraft protection as a line of credit. If you get washed out of payday loans and overdraft protection for some reason, say because you don't have a bank account, the next notch down is usually pawn shops, which is pawn shops cater to people who don't have bank accounts or can't get access to payday loans anymore, which is there actually are people who can't get payday loans anymore because they haven't paid them off or have had their bank accounts canceled because of too much overdraft and that sort of thing. And then down below the pawn shops are, you know, rent to own and things like that. But what we see is that we may not like the choices available to people who use payday loans, but given the situation they're in, they act rationally, which is they use payday loans. They would use credit cards if they could. They don't have access to credit cards, and payday loans are better than pawn shops. The other thing that's interesting is even in deciding between whether to use a payday loan and an overdraft loan, consumers actually make that choice rationally. And I've got an article that you can find online at SSRN.com about discussing how people use payday loans versus overdraft protection. So you know, the point is that it makes sense why people use payday loans, given their situation. And to pretend like they're not in that situation is not going to help them. And in particular, these are people with limited choices. And basic economics says, by and large, taking away choices from people who already have limited choices generally does not make them better off. And that's what the literature tends to show on payday lending, is that when you take away payday lending, people are more likely to bounce checks. They're more likely to be evicted from, for non-payment of rent and the like. And so now, you know, these are pretty tragic kind of situations. But what experience tends to show is that taking away the option of payday loans, for instance, generally does not make people better off.
Yeah, no, as I'm listening to you talk about this, I'm thinking of kind of some observations people have made about Elizabeth Warren type thinking recently. Most, you know, Joel Kotkin has a new book on the new elites, and you know, one of the points that he makes is they really don't care about a lower middle class rising, in the same way elites of past generations in American life did. And one measure of that is the things that they're producing, in particular, say, digital technology elites, doesn't really depend upon a large middle class. So one can buy it without necessarily having that type of a job. And I wonder, as I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, their kind of response is you don't really need those choices. The idea that you would need some consumer credit to float you, so you might actually start to make better choices and redeem yourself financially, where you actually are kind of a middle class consumer. We're not really too concerned about that because we've got other ways to help you, namely government entitlement, welfare, redistributive type programs, and that's actually a better way for you to go. Thinking about
that.
Yeah,
go ahead. I was going to say, that's a marvelous insight, Richard. Now, I'll just be brief on two things, which is, first, what we see is, that's exactly right, which is that use of payday loans, pawn shops, those sorts of things, tends to be a life cycle effect, which is early on in your life, you tend to use those products more. As you get out, you get established, you get a job, you work your way up. So it's a transition phase for most people. The second thing you put your finger on, I think, is a great insider, you know, observation, which is, What has been the Elizabeth Warren, the Obama administration response to the fact that consumers are, that they've regulated away basically bank accounts or credit cards and that sort of thing? We see two things. The first is, inevitably, what they're going to do is basically tell banks to just give people bank accounts and run it as a loss, right?
Yeah.
They've taken away the incentives to serve these people. They'll just basically mandate they do it. And what's the second? This kooky idea for post office banking. Right, which you may be familiar with, which is Elizabeth Warren's dream, is that the post office is going to get in the small loan business and basically replace payday lenders. Which the irony of that is, they think it's going to be a new profit source for the post office. But what I think is so amusing about that is, why do people use payday loans? In part because it's got good customer service and it's fast.
Yeah.
And one thing you could say about the post office is that they're not known for the customer service and speed, right?
No. Well, you know, they might have some competition from Walmart.
Exactly. Walmart is, you know, that's where we should be going, right?
Yeah.
The model should be innovation. That's the model of unleashing competition and allowing Walmart to get into banking. And, you know, the big banks have blocked Walmart from actually getting a banking charter. Unfortunately, Walmart is working around that. But yeah. Walmart has the best prepaid card out there. They've got low-cost, good services. Instead, what the Elizabeth Warren mindset with post office banking is, essentially the government's going to do it. We're going to run as a public utility, right? That's not going to help consumers in the long run. The key is getting rid of these barriers, these obstacles to innovation, and basically recognizing that low-income consumers, young consumers, that can be a profitable for businesses, just like they are for everybody else. And think about how we allow innovation, online banking, mobile banking, all these different sorts of innovative things, get regulation out of the way and allow market experimentation to step in to figure out what's the best way to deliver banking and credit services to these people.
So banking, Walmart with banking strikes me as a focal point of opposition for progressives. It'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. Maybe we can end Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. A lot has been written on its unaccountability. And it's designed into the way it was established to have very little congressional oversight. So do these policies, we talk about, you say within American history, there's kind of an ebb and a flow of pro-consumer credit, anti-consumer credit legislation. But are we now set for a future of decreasing consumer credit because of what this powerful agency can do without accountability to any sort of free market type arguments that a Todd Zwicky is going to make?
I'm afraid so, which is and it won't be in a coherent way, right? Which is that they'll just kind of choke off credit, and I think that we understand. I've written on this also. We understand why regulatory agencies aren't designed like the CFPB anymore, right? With just allowing bureaucrats complete sway to run the economy. We tried that experiment. It was called the Nixon administration, and we decided that in the Nixon administration, that sort of allowing regulators to just run the economy without supervision turned out to undermine dynamism and slow down the economy. So we know that the bureaucracies tend to have their own biases, to have their own their own mistakes, or what we call technically type one versus type two errors. And I think what we are going to get with the CFPB is a restriction on credit. They're going to crack down on payday loans. We've already seen a loss of access to credit cards, especially for low-income consumers, et cetera, et cetera. What I think is tragic about that, and we're seeing it already, is history tells us that in the long run, this comes back to bite us. In the long run, it's low-income consumers who are the ones who are most hurt when we have these sorts of regulations, as we see in the mortgage markets, as we see in credit card markets and the like. And so I'm afraid that where we are headed is in that direction. Historically, that's always invited the loan sharks in. Inevitably, the loan sharks have come back, and one can only hope that that the CFPB rights the ship before Fat Tony's heirs decide that to take the entrepreneurial opportunity to step into the market that we've blissfully kept them out of for the last 30 years or so.
No, my sense is we'll hear a lot of blame put on the banks for not extending credit to consumers, and we'll hear cries of racism and things like this as we do. But people like you, Todd, will need to run the CFPB. We need to put our people in charge, and then we'll be okay. Todd, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate
this. Thank you, Richard.
The book is Consumer Credit and the American Economy. We've been talking with one of the authors, Todd Zwicky. Thank you so much, Todd.
Thanks, Richard.
This is your host, Richard Reinsch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, and find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org.